have some degree of greater confidence that you belong to something bigger than yourself.
You can like watch history happen or you can choose to be a part of it.
I just like that feeling of making people feel.
The Frame is 5 years old, and today we celebrate that anniversary with some of our favorite Frame moments. We travel back to memorable interviews, dynamic guests, strange locations, some tears, and a few laughs.
There's a bathtub a writing desk in the bathtub.
No, there's actually a desk in front of the toilet.
That's the difference between LA and New York. You can be who you are and have the space to be that.
I'm far too old not to walk my own talk.
It's a bad day when that happens, man. It's a bad day. I still feel that pain, John.
From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, I'm John Horn. This is the Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Stay with us.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is The Frame, a daily report from the world of art, entertainment, and culture. Here's your host, John Horn.
Welcome, everyone. It's our very first day on the air in the afternoon. Okay, I was a little scratchy back then. That was November 10th, 2014, when The Frame went on the air for the first time. Today, we celebrate the first 5 years of the show with some of our favorite moments, covering the cultural world and spending time with the people who inhabit it. Let's do this. Thanks for coming back on the show. Let's do it. If you need a cough, cough. Let's do it. Make sure your mobile phone is off. We're not live. You sound great on our end. So let's do it. You sound great on our end. If you need to swear, we'll bleep you out. When we launched The Frame, we were doing something for the very first time. I had been a print reporter my entire life, so we asked our early guests for stories when they first succeeded or failed.
We have a 30-second request.
All right, let's hear
it. Launching our show in 2 weeks. Everybody who comes on is saying the first thing that something happened.
Hi, I'm Gina Davis, and the first time I got cast in a movie was in Tootsie.
My name is Antoine Fuqua. The first job that I failed and actually got fired on was American Gangster.
I'm Jon Stewart. The first time I bombed on stage, funnily enough, was the first time I was on stage.
For some reason, I was absolutely not nervous at all. My first scene was with Dustin Hoffman in my underwear.
But what I learned from that was it's not all about me all the time. And you have to learn how to navigate sometimes as a filmmaker.
The Bitter End, New York City, 1 o'clock in the morning, following three Doors cover bands. I had a good 5 minutes prepared. About 2 minutes into it, the audience realized I might suck at this.
But the funniest thing was, I didn't know you're only supposed to come on the days that you're working. And nobody bothered to tell me for 6 weeks. I showed up at 6 and went home when everybody else did. I'd get a chair and put it right next to Sidney Pollack and sit there all day.
It's a bad day when that happens, man. It's a bad day. I still feel that pain, John. I still feel it.
As I walked into the night, I thought to myself, you know, there are a lot of law schools. I could go to them.
And our first ever guest in 2014 was Christopher Nolan. He was about to release his movie, Interstellar. A lot of people are saying that this is your most personal film. How do you respond to that? Do you take it as a compliment? Do you think they might be right?
I think they don't know me, so how would they know? I don't know.
Well, maybe you know yourself.
I don't know myself terribly well either.
There have been a lot of real-world events that have driven our coverage over the years, but the one that coincided with our launch was the Sony hack.
Today, the U.S. government pointed the finger of blame directly at North Korea for the devastating cyber attack against Sony Pictures.
Posters taken down, the movie, The Interview, that poked fun at the North Korean dictator, Pol.
They caused a lot of damage.
The cyber attack of Sony Pictures, which allegedly was conducted by North Korea, came in response to a movie. It was called The Interview. It starred Seth Rogen and James Franco. It was a crazy story. It evolved every day. And in the middle of it, Dan Sterling, who was the screenwriter of The Interview, was with us in studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's very rare that a screenwriter is like with us to talk about breaking news. So I guess my breaking news question is, What the hell's going on today?
Well, I just know what's going on in my email inbox, which is an increasing flood of people asking me if I'm okay, both emotionally, physically, and financially.
What's your answer? What do you tell them?
You know, I was at a party on a Saturday night where the host was introducing me to everybody at the party as, this is the guy that brought down Sony. Yeah, that's right. It was funny.
Were you flattered by that?
Well, the first 400 or 500 times the joke was made, it was funny. Except actually, it's in a way, it's actually not funny to me. It's been a surreal experience. I'm still very much in the middle of it. The one thing that I know that I'm not happy about is actually the real suffering that is going on at Sony. Not just by the person who greenlit my film so bravely, but also by all the other people affected by the hack. I'm quite concerned about them.
There's so much about this story, and we'll get to the film in a sure. second, but what about the reaction to the film itself has been the most surprising to you?
Well, look, about a year ago today, I was on a soundstage, and I was at the monitor watching Seth Rogen, who was completely naked except for a sock around his penis. And he had a bunch of salami tucked between his buttocks that a German shepherd was eating out of, because the scene was he was being sniffed by a bomb-sniffing dog. And I was laughing my head off, sitting next to his mother, who seemed to be used to these sorts of things, and she was knitting a scarf. And at the time, nothing like any of this could have occurred to me, because the movie is just, in our minds, was supposed to be an outrageous, of course, somewhat provocative, but totally hilarious comedy, which I think that it is. But the reaction by the North Korean government was surprising to me. All of the things that have ensued have been... I was quite naive going into this.
That was screenwriter Dan Sterling on our show in 2014. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame's 5th anniversary special.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night.
For music fans, this is one of those days that you will probably always remember, where you were when you heard the news that Prince had died.
This is Oscar Garza, senior producer of The Frame. One of the memories that sticks out for me from our first 5 years is the day we had to report on the death of one of my musical heroes. There have been reports that Prince wasn't well, but certainly no indication that he was hooked on opioids, so it was a shock that he was gone. But like every day, we simply put our heads down and focused on producing the show. Once we were done, though, I started thinking of the times that I witnessed his electric live shows, and it was incredibly sad to realize that he'd never take the stage again.
I'm John Horn. You're listening to The Frame's 5th anniversary special. On the show, we're always interested in how and why artists do what they do, especially if they're working a little bit outside the norm.
I wanted it to be kind of an innocent show a little bit, where it wasn't too vulgar. And I think that I wanted the lead character to not talk so much. And I wanted there to be old-fashioned physical comedy. And I wanted to set it in the world of rodeo clowns. Right out of the gate, a terrible idea, all of it.
Zach Galifianakis is the co-creator and star of the FX series Baskets. Here he is in 2017.
We just tonally wanted to make it a little bit different enough, because I think comedies have kind of gotten very one note. And this isn't really even I wouldn't even call it too much of just a straight comedy. We call it a slapstick drama on set. So we just kind of wanted to do a different show and see if we could get away with it, different totally, and different in the casting, and you know, the music and the way the jokes were delivered.
Let me ask you a little bit more about the casting, because outside of, you know, people like Louis Anderson, the nature of the casting feels essentially like you're just grabbing people off the streets. And I mean that... But I mean that as a compliment.
How could I take it any other way?
I mean,
how could I take it any other way but a compliment?
I mean, like, even the person who's working the front desk at the Reagan Museum, it just feels like that person is probably, when she's not on baskets, working the front desk at the Reagan Museum.
She works at the that actress actually worked at the Ron Reagan Jr. Library. That's where we got her from. Yes, authenticity is everything. I mean, you look at TV sometimes, and it's very glossy and very fast-paced, and I think, I don't know any of those kind of people.
I'm John Horn, and this is the Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Sometimes the secrets behind your favorite shows are held by people whose names you don't know, like this Game of Thrones sound designer.
I'm Paula Fairfield, and I do all the kind of fantastical stuff on the show. The White Walkers, the dire wolves, mammoths. But one of the biggest things, obviously, that I do is the dragons. Well, the funniest part about this is that with the purr sounds, I hunted and hunted for just the right sound. And while I was trolling around, I found a sound of two giant tortoises having sex. And I'm not kidding. And the moan from the male is what I took as the basis for the purring of young Drogon. And what's funny about it is that I remember watching people watch it, and every time that sound would come up, people would giggle. And it was just funny. It was just automatic because it has a primal element still in there. So knowing that, as I proceeded through the seasons, I have actively looked for sounds of larger and larger animals having sex. There's also very tender moments, and one of the things, I have a dog that I trained in police dog work, and one of the most beautiful sounds from her is when she comes up and is very tender in my ear, and there's a very tiny, barely audible nose whistle. And it's one of the most beautiful sounds coming from a very powerful animal. So it's a sound I started using in the very bigger, like last year when Drogon shows up, you'll hear these beautiful nose whistles. They're from my dog. And and that is another sign of just tenderness.
Drogon.
No, it's always been personal. I mean, I tell myself stories when I create. I have to. And the trajectory of each scene, I find a story that I tell myself, and often it is personal stuff.
That piece was produced by James Kim, who is one of our original producers. I'm John Horn, and this is the Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Over the years, artists have shared how the changing political climate has affected their work. One example is the playwright John Robin Bates. Before the 2016 election, he wrote a play called Vicuña with a Trump-like character. He mounted it in L.A. A year later, he launched a revised version in Washington.
On the night of the inauguration, I was in D.C. For the Women's March, which was the next morning. And I got into an altercation with a Trump celebrant. And it led to sort of an act of physical violence that I'm not going to actually kind of talk about too much because unfortunately I can't. But what I felt that night was that there had been an emboldening and a permission given to dark forces, the kind of dark forces that we now see in Charlottesville and elsewhere. And I thought that play, as it stands now, maybe is worth revisiting and adding to. And we have to find ways to be together. You know, people asked me last night at a talk back here in D.C., what's the answer to all this? Because the play in its epilogue ends with a question now. And the answer is numbers. And in a weird way, I thought I could justify getting back to the play because it brings us together. I'm very corny about what the theater is still, and I do believe it's a sort of gathering and a church and a communal act, and that it has a deep social relevance and resonance, or else it's nothing. And so it brought me back to working on it, and doing it in D.C. felt like the right place a year later.
Let me ask you about the question in the epilogue. It's, what are you doing to prevent this? So why was that the question that you felt needed to be asked in the epilogue?
It's the only question I think I live with, is what are you doing to prevent this? What are you doing to counter it? What are you doing to answer it? When will you not remain silent? How can you remain silent? And it became the important question of my life. Growing up in comfort, I think I mentioned this to you before, in apartheid-era South Africa as a privileged American kid, watching not just complacency, but complicity in most of white South Africa. What are you doing to prevent this essentially an essential evil? And so I started asking that then. But it's time to ask that question all the time now. You know, I have friends and family who are trans and people of color and immigrants, and they are under constant threat. And so it's up to people like me and maybe most of our listeners that can to be in opposition to it vocally, actively.
Coming up, Meryl Streep and a visit with Lizzo in her LA studio. That's next on the Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Stay with us.
Hello, it's Bryan Cranston, and you're listening to The Frame on 89.3 KPCC. And now, here's John Horn.
Thank you, Brian. Welcome back to The Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Producing a daily show can sometimes make it hard to get out of the studio, but we do it. I'm a cyclist, and I've actually done interviews on bicycles. The first one didn't go so well.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! Sorry, I said right on 23rd, but that's...
I am so sorry. Are you okay? Oh, my God. No, I've never done that. I thought you said we'll go right here.
Sorry, I said right on...
Are you okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
That was me trying to interview TV writer Tom Smuts in 2014. A couple of days later, he safely rode his bike to the Emmys, probably because I wasn't with him. This trip to the L.A. River with filmmaker Karan Kusama went a lot better. Maybe because we were on foot.
Depending on where the light was, when we would scout, you could look into the river and just see giant fish. And it was sort of like, are they four-headed? But they weren't. They seemed intact and normal. And then also herons and cranes and people bathing, like that person washing their clothes right now.
A key scene from her 2018 Nicole Kidman movie Destroyer was shot along the banks of the LA River.
When you were thinking about how you wanted to cast the city of LA in this film,
What were the conversations you had with your locations department? Because oddly enough, I think one of your location scouts worked on La La Land, which is a very, very different portrait of Los Angeles than you have in Destroyer.
In fact, our location manager and a lot of his team worked on La La Land, and he was so excited for the opportunity to do this like gritty version of LA, and also a sense of seeing the LA that we don't see as frequently, the kind of the neglected parts cinematically on film. And there was something about this like wild green landscape coming up against these like concrete slopes that felt, I don't know, like we hadn't seen much of that yet.
That was filmmaker Karan Kusama on The Frame in 2018. In 2015, we visited with visual artist Mark Bradford in his studio, a former warehouse for a welding company.
It's a light industry area of Los Angeles that's pretty bustling in the 80s and 90s, kind of probably fell on hard times and is kind of back again.
Bradford has been connected to the South LA community where he now works since the beginning, really. He was raised by a single mother in the West Adams neighborhood, and he would go on to work at his mom's Leimert Park hair salon.
Oftentimes, women come into the hair salon. I only dealt with African-American women, and their hair is naturally, you know, woolly. We have woolly hair. And they show me a picture of Beyonce. So I have to take that hair from this state and will it into that state. Press it, weave it, color it, and damn it, by the time it's over, it looks as close to Beyonce as I can get it. I've always been, that's how I learned my craft, is taking it from one state and moving it to another state. So I think in the art practice, I don't think it was any different.
If you're doing a piece for a show that has a definite opening date, you kind of know when you have to finish.
Oh, yeah.
How do you know if you don't have a deadline when a piece is done?
It's like a relationship. You know when it's done. You just know when it's done. It may take you a while to get out of it, but you know when a relationship is done. You go your way, I go my way, and you absolutely know when that's over. It's the same thing. I go through all of the arc in a relationship with every single painting that I do.
That was Mark Bradford from 2015, and this is The Frame 5th Anniversary Special. Another memorable time out of the office was when we went to visit with Guillermo del Toro. He invited us to tour his creative lair.
The house is a library of images and a library of sounds and a library of ideas.
He calls it Bleak House. There's a secret room inspired by Disney's Haunted Mansion, complete with gargoyles and some 10,000 items.
I am the caretaker. And like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, I've been here forever. So I assemble the bookshelves, I clean, I dust. And the house is truly, truly an installation, if you would. You know, it is not a hoarder house. It's not a house where things are out of order. They have an order. They have a reason. You know, and what is important is that it speaks intimately to me.
So do you ever spend the night here?
Yeah, in the first floor, yeah. The second floor is kind of scary.
What does that mean?
there have been strange noises in the second floor. And I don't believe in anything, but we in Mexico we have a saying, I don't believe in witches, but they're real.
Okay, now we're entering one more room.
Yeah, this is the film book room.
So yeah, this is kind of history of
general
movies.
Film, but in the projection room I have my favorite filmmakers.
Where is that room?
Come see it.
Because I remember the first time I visited you at your original Bleak House, you had just thousands of DVDs.
Oh, I have a
Where
seven,
did those go well, now that everything's online?
I have 7,000 DVDs and Blu-rays.
DVDs.
I have about 200 laser discs. I have about 50 VHS, and I have one Betamax.
You're the last man with a Betamax.
But I have a Betamax system because it's the only copy.
I have to say, there's a bathtub with a writing desk in the bathtub.
No, there's actually a desk in front of the toilet.
And there's a desk in front of the toilet.
Yes.
Guillermo del Toro, thank you so much for your
Thank you, man.
This is The Frame 5th Anniversary Special. I'm John Horn.
Darby Maloney, editor of The Frame. On November 10th, 2016, the day after the presidential election, Lizzo performed on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and I was floored.
Hey, the only person who can make America great is you. And if you feel me, I want everybody on your feet, because we're going to celebrate.
After that, I was determined to get her on the show. Almost a year later, John and I went out to her studio up a windy road near Dodger Stadium.
And that's what I like about this studio is that, like, I feel like I'm in nature. So I'm not, like, in a casino of a studio where it's, like, I don't know what time of day it is and I have no connection to the earth.
I want to ask you about something that happened almost, I think, exactly a year ago.
We are going to get up, change our Pampers, brush off our shoulders, and push on through together. Please welcome Lizzo.
And you began your performance by singing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is also known as the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty.
We were on the plane flying to New York, and I was watching the election on the back of someone's head. And I went to sleep, and I woke up in New York, and I woke up in a Trump presidency. And I had been thinking about it on the whole drive there. And then Samantha came in my dressing room and she asked me, she was like crying. She was so devastated. And she was like, whatever you want to do, what do you want to do? And I was like, we're going to continue to do good as hell because first off, I have a job to do. And like part of that job is to uplift people. So when I thought of Lift Every Voice, I asked her, I was like, well, can you see if this is cleared? Can I sing this on television? And they just were like, we don't even care if you can. And they did the research and they were like, you can. And then I was like, okay, horns, just play this one note and I'll sing over that.
Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us.
I realize there's like two things. You can like watch history happen or you can choose to be a part of it. And instead of ignoring it, I chose to engage in it. And it worked.
That was Lizzo in 2017. You're listening to the Frame Anniversary Special. I'm John Horn, and we're celebrating our fifth year on the air. One issue we've always covered on the show is equality and inclusion, especially in Hollywood. Here's Meryl Streep from 2015.
What's on our screens is our history, you know, it in a non-reading world. So it's important. It's important that women's stories and the things that interest them, concern them, confound them, are on our screens. That's important because it'll define us.
I think it's easy for people to assume that this issue or the broader issue of equality has been resolved. I suspect a lot of people, including yourself, would have a very different opinion.
Yeah, I think it's a fight that's not over. But I probably shouldn't say a fight. I think it should be an agreement. It should be an agreement within the human family that both sides are important. And it seems to be very, very difficult to get that agreement. I just think that somehow it's an interior change in the minds of men. I still, when you bring up anything that sort of has the roseate cast of feminism to it, even the most enlightened men I can feel, even my husband, they kind of go, they're exhausted by this subject because it's not their subject. But I want it to be. I want it to be everyone's. I don't want women's rights to be a women's issue.
That was Meryl Streep from our show in 2015. The next year, I went through my own unconscious bias training with producer Kathy Schulman. You came on my show not that long ago, and I asked you a question about what it's like to be a parent and be away from your children when you're producing a movie.
And my wife said, why don't you ask that question of men? And I said, you're absolutely right. And that is my bias, that I'm going to assume that there are things that a woman does away from work that a man doesn't do. And that is really kind of really horrible that I assume that about you, but not of a man.
You know, it's so interesting you say that, John, because you just literally landed on the terms of rejection that I as a producer experienced most. What would happen to me is that I would sell a movie to a major studio, and it would get closer and closer to the time that the movie was actually going to be made. And with no exception, each time I was asked to bring on a male producer to produce the movie with me. And I think one of the reasons I was asked that was because I had done a lot of low-budget movies, and the theory was you're going to need an experienced man to help you go for more days. And I would fight that like a crazy person. Like, I just, it doesn't matter how long the shoot is, I know what I'm doing. But every time that person who was now suggesting that I split my fee with a male producer who was going to now come help me, an Academy Award-winning producer, make my movie, it was couched in this way. You can't possibly want to leave your daughter. You are a mom and a wife, right? I mean, I can only imagine that if you could split it with somebody else, it'll be easier for you to go back and forth.
This is said explicitly.
Explicitly, each time, with no exception.
That was film producer Kathy Schulman from 2016. You're listening to the Frame Anniversary Special. I'm John Horn, and we're celebrating 5 years on the air.
Let's see if we're in the right place.
Hi, we're here to see Ava. Filmmaker Ava DuVernay is a founding member of Time's Up, and through her company Array, she's a tireless champion for new voices and expanding who gets included in Hollywood.
What LA means to me is it is a true educational experience to me because there's a little bit of everyone here and they have space. That's the difference between LA and New York. You can be who you are and have the space to be that. This is a sprawl. And so whether you're in spaces where it's a large Persian community, you know, I love driving through behind Melrose because I always see beautiful families, Orthodox Jewish families walking together. And then I go a little bit further and I'm in Koreatown. And it's not just a block. Like, it's a full little city, you know what I mean? People can really put their roots down here and it grows into these beautiful kind of flowers of an array of people. That's what I love about it. And I grew up in Compton, which was not just a black space. Compton, Linwood, Long Beach, Southgate. It was black and brown. It's Filipino, Guatemalan, Mexican, black, American, African, and that's the kind of city this is. It starts to get very homogenous when you get into quote-unquote Hollywood, but that's not really L.A. I hate it when people come here and they go to Beverly Hills and they're like, ah, it's kind of fake. I'm like, dude, you didn't go anywhere. You went from LAX to, like, the Beverly Hilton. You didn't experience it.
That was from a visit with director and producer Ava DuVernay earlier this year. You're listening to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and we're celebrating 5 years on the air.
Hey, this is Jonathan Shiflett. I'm one of the producers on The Frame. And one of the things I love about producing interviews for this show is getting out of the studio and into the field. We do a lot of interviews with just a pair of mics and a portable recorder, and sometimes getting good audio can be a challenge, but it's always kind of fun when we end up in weird places. Like the Telluride Film Festival when John had to climb in the back of an SUV with James Mangold.
Where are we, James? I want you to describe the
scene.
We're
in a meadow.
Or in some cases, the venue becomes part of the story, like when John talked with LA Times music critic Bob Hilburn, and they were standing outside the Troubadour in West Hollywood, where Hilburn discovered a young Elton John.
Almost 50 years ago.
I know, that's what's amazing, John, that Elton and Bernie and I and the Troubadour are all here still.
Wherever we go, it's always a really long drive back to Pasadena. Luckily, I'm decent competition for John when it comes to a guessing game called What 70s Rock Band is on the Radio?
Coming up on The Frame 5th Anniversary Special, Emma Thompson, Tom Hanks, and Jordan Peele. That's next. Stay with us.
From the Mone Broadcast Center, this is The Frame, a daily report on the world of art, entertainment, and culture. And here's your host, John Horn.
Thank you, Professor Xavier. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame 5th Anniversary Special. There have been a lot of news events over The Frame's first 5 years, but one that has really shaped our coverage was the reporting in October of 2017 about Harvey Weinstein's long history of alleged sexual abuse and assault.
Now to the latest on Harvey Weinstein. The New York Times reporting allegations by numerous women who say the Hollywood mogul sexually harassed them.
His alleged Ronan Farrow has written a, frankly, harrowing account of the harassment and assault and rape allegations against Harvey Weinstein.
Mr. Weinstein did not invent the casting couch in Hollywood, and to the extent that there is bad behavior in that industry, that is not what this is about.
We're going to need a new Oscar category this year. Best actor whose movies we can't watch anymore. And you know, in fact, now that I think about it, all women in Hollywood should win double Oscars for acting like all the men were cool all along. Every single one of them.
Following the Weinstein news, we ran numerous segments on multiple aspects of the story, from the toxic use of non-disclosure agreements to safety on movie and TV sets. Here's a part of our conversation with the actress and writer, Zoe Kazan.
I think that the history of our industry, of the movie industry, is a history in which women have been sexually harassed, raped, coerced, treated like objects, treated disposably, treated as if like we're not perennials, you know, treated as if every season they need to plant a new crop of bulbs and those bulbs are women. And once you cut those flowers, there's no more use for the plant. You know, there's a long history of women being treated poorly in our industry. And like even the fact that we have like a concept of a casting couch that people use colloquially is meaningful. You know, when these allegations first started coming out against Harvey Weinstein, who I have no personal experience with, I have to say, everyone knows.
Right.
Right? Like 90%, like Louis C.K., Kevin Spacey, like these are names that, like for years, we've heard like whispers and stories and and like you want to look away with some of them, like I certainly did with Louis C.K., but you know, you hear them. I had a lot of fear when these allegations came out against Harvey Weinstein that people were going to treat him like the exception instead of the apotheosis of the problem. And these women who have come out, women and men who have come out since then about other people, I think are like real heroes because they are making it impossible for us to say it is just Harvey Weinstein.
Emma Thompson also had something to say about this issue. John Lasseter, who was forced out of his job as the head of Pixar and Walt Disney Animation over his treatment of women, was hired by an animation company that Thompson was going to make a film with. When they hired Lasseter, she spoke out.
I'm far too old not to walk my own talk. Time is very much marching on, and because I had spoken up before when the Weinstein thing blew up, and I've always spoken up about this since I was a young woman, there was absolutely no choice, really. And what was interesting to me and very touching was the responses I got from so many people, male and female, who had done the same thing, who had walked away and who perhaps don't feel as established as I feel. You know, I can do other things. It's not going to kill my career, even if Skydance says, right, we're never going to work with you again and we're going to tell every other animation not to work. But I don't think that that would be possible now, because I do feel that with the Me Too Time's Up movement, there is a tipping point. But we do have to keep on. And one of the ways in which I think we're going to have to do that is we've got to talk to people before, during and after film shoots. It's got to be a practical thing that happens on a daily basis while we're actually doing the work, because we've had a lot of historical stuff. For instance, one of the things I did recently, which was incredibly helpful to me, was I got a lot of the young women who'd worked on Last Christmas together for an informal meeting about what it had been like to shoot that film and how comfortable they'd been and whether they'd had any moments of discomfort. And of course they had. And I didn't know about
them.
What
kinds of things?
They just had had experiences with some people on our crew that had made them uncomfortable. And they'd been bullied from time to time. And it, of course, it happens. The clever thing about anybody who's going to bully is that they'll do it not in front of someone who's going to say, you can't do that. They'll do it in secret or in quiet or in private. And it's very difficult, for instance, for someone who's a runner and who can be replaced in 5 minutes to say anything bad about someone who it will cost a lot of money to replace. And all of these things, they have implications for everyone.
I'm going to ask you a favor right now, and this is not part of your letter that's specific to Skydancer John Lasseter. I'm going to ask you to read two paragraphs from it because I think it's something that everybody needs to hear.
If a man has been touching women inappropriately for decades, why would a woman want to work for him if the only reason he's not touching them inappropriately now is that it says in his contract that he must behave professionally? If a man has made women at his companies feel undervalued and disrespected for decades, why should the woman at his new company think that any respect he shows them is anything other than an act that he's required to perform by his coach, his therapist, and his employment agreement? The message seems to be, I am learning to feel respect for women, so please be patient while I work on it. It's not easy.
That was Emma Thompson reading from her letter to Skydance Animation about John Lasseter. You're listening to The Frame 5th Anniversary Special, and we're taking a trip down memory lane, like this visit with Jordan Peele when he released Get Out.
This movie had to feel cinematic in a way that, you know, only a real handful of my favorite horror movies, you know, pull off a year. We would approach this like an elevated art, like it was high art. We would try to approach this with Kubrickian precision and, of course, fall short, but die trying.
Unlike Stanley Kubrick, you made the movie a little faster than he typically works, though.
Yeah, that's right.
You clearly pay a lot of attention to music. We have some horror music cues lined up for you. I'm going to test to see how much of a horror movie music nerd you really are. Hit you me. Ready to play? Let's hear the first cue.
Okay, that's John Carpenter's Halloween. That's the Tubular Bells from Exorcist.
Okay, one for one. Ready? Next cue.
John Carpenter's Halloween. I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming.
Okay, next cue.
Okay, that's going to be Psycho.
Very good. Three for three.
Bernard Herrmann.
Okay, cue four.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Very good.
I believe it's Angelo Ballardimente.
You're crushing it. Okay, next cue.
Okay, Mika Levy.
Very, very, very impressive.
One of the greats.
And the last one.
Okay, this is Philip Glass's Candyman. What do you think about that?
That was unbelievable.
What do you think about that?
That's unbelievable. Another memorable moment was when Tanya Saracho, creator of the Starz series Vita, demonstrated the vocal talent she used on her day jobs as her writing career got going.
I was, for 10 years, I was a voice in Spanish for Special K. And the tag was always, con Special K, te puedes ver y sentir como tú quieras. Like, you're so friendly. And then 10 years for Walgreens. Esta semana en Walgreens usted puede comprar papel higiénico por $2.99. 10 years. That's how,
wow,
I was able to write plays and not starve in Chicago because I was doing voices.
So how does one move from theater to television? Is it a natural transition? Was it something you were aiming for to just kind of fall in your lap?
No, I had my own little theater company. Look, one time in 2009, I guess an article came out in the Chicago Tribune when they compared, this writing is a lot like Genji Kohn's Weeds, right? And somebody from Genji's company called. They were like, we want a sample. We want to read your sample if this is, you know. And I was in tech. Do you know what tech, like?
Yeah, and through dress rehearsal.
Right.
You're really getting lighting cues, sound cues done for a play.
In a 49-seat theater. I thought I had made it. So I go, no, thank you. I don't do that. And like hung up basically. I was like, I don't, TV? What? No. And then they call the next day. You really need to send us a sample. And I was like, I don't. I'm in tech. I said, I was like, so like that was into like 09 or something or 2010 that I had. So no, it was never a thing.
And when Tom Hanks and Clint Eastwood made a movie about the pilot Sully Sullenberger, I asked them about what it means to be a hero and to play one on screen.
Tom, I think the other day gave a definition of a hero that I thought was spot on. To me, it's somebody who does something extraordinary, and yet he doesn't think it's extraordinary. I mean, he may think, well, I was on my game that week, but it is extraordinary in our eyes.
There is this projection that is put upon you that because you played these guys, you actually have some of the attributes that you do. And believe me, my skill set is to make it appear as though I have these attributes without having any of the actual attributes. That being said, as an audience guy, as a guy who saw movies as I was growing up, that the power of the cinema and the power of the heroic visions, the guy that you can rely on in motion pictures, makes you feel as though when you leave the theater that you spent that time very, very well, that you have some degree of greater confidence, that you belong to something bigger than yourself, that there are people that you can have faith in. And for me, look, you know, I went to the movies in the 70s, so I actually sort of grew up thinking like Travis Bickle was one of the coolest guys in the world, the Taxi Driver. Now, a lot of people would disagree with you on that, but yet there was still even that element of you ask yourself a question that always comes down to being some version of what would I do if I was in the same circumstances? And when you see these movies, they actually are a bit of a primer that explain you have to be dedicated and you have to be trained and you have to follow through. So somewhere you have to make a decision as a human being. Am I going to be the type of person that's going to try to make the world a better place? And if you get that lesson from literature, from opera, from theater, from Shakespeare, cinema rates as one of those great art forms. And so, yes, you actually do become enlightened in a way by heroic portrayals, big and small.
This is the Frame 5th Anniversary Special. We're revisiting moments from our first 5 years on the air.
This is Monica Bushman. I'm a producer on The Frame, and I'm also a crier. I cry at the movies and watching TV shows, and even during some commercials. I try not to cry at work, but one of the things that I really enjoy about working on The Frame is that John Horn is a crier too. He cries at work, and he's not at all ashamed about it. A time that stands out for me was when he was talking with Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle. They're the creators and stars of the Hulu show Pen 15.
It's a beautiful scene, but it's really, I mean, I'm crying. But it's real.
Jonathan Shiflett, one of the other producers here, remembered this moment from John's interview with Randy Newman.
And when she was sad, I was there to dry her tears.
And when I didn't make it through without crying.
Oh.
And Julia Paskin recalled this moment from an interview she produced with Mahershala Ali.
You're in the middle of the world, man.
When he and John talked about the powerful swimming lesson scene from Moonlight.
It's all I can do to not cry in this scene.
It brings up so much for me, man. It really does.
So be a little more like John Horn. Go ahead and shed a tear and don't feel bad about it.
My name is Julia Paskin. I'm a producer for The Frame. And one of my favorite memories is when we interviewed the creators of Undone, the Amazon series. It was Kate Purdy and Raphael Bob Waksberg.
You two met on BoJack, I believe.
Yes.
And I initially thought that Undone and BoJack don't have a lot in common. And I was talking with my producer, Julia Paskin, and she's like, they do. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that, of course, she was right and I was wrong.
As producers, we do a lot of research and we have a lot of conversations before the interview and really talk out the different scenarios and filter through the information with John. And so it's a group labor of love a lot of the time. And John is really great because he will occasionally give us a shout out for all of that behind the scenes hard work.
And that'll do it.
That was great.
That's great. That was great. Thank you for joining us. No, it was great.
Thank you. Great. Yeah,
that was perfect.
That was great. That was awesome. Who was your high school drama teacher?
That was awesome.
That was awesome.
That was fantastic.
That was awesome.
That was great.
I want to thank everybody who has tuned in over the years. Thank you for listening to The Frame. I also want to thank Colin Campbell, who hired us to start this show back in 2014, and our current program director, Sal Locurto, who guides us now. And thanks to the Budos Band, which supplied our original theme music, and to Taylor McFerrin, who wrote our current theme song. The Frame is produced by Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Monica Bushman, and Julia Paskin. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Our original producers are Michelle Lanz and James Kim. Eduardo Perez is our engineer, and we say goodbye this month to our longtime engineer, Valentino Rivera. Thank you, Val. Get some sleep. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza, and I'm John Horn. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, thanks for being part of our Frame family. We'll see you back here for the daily version of The Frame on Monday.